Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune into the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
Donald Trump faces a fourth criminal case as a grand jury alleges that he and 18 others conspired to undermine democracy.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
Plus, China and Russia take emergency measures to shore up their ailing economies, and how streaming giants are betting on higher prices to boost business. It's Tuesday, August 15th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in Georgia, where a grand jury has charged former President Donald Trump with attempting to overturn the 2020 election result and undermining democracy. The sweeping indictment charges 19 people in total, alleging that Rudy Giuliani and other Trump allies operated a criminal enterprise that sought to overturn Joe Biden's electoral victory in Georgia. It also marks the fourth time that the former president has been indicted this year and deepens Trump's legal woes ahead of the 2024 election. Journal legal affairs correspondent Yann Wolf has been looking into the 97-page indictment, and he joins me now with more. Yann, what are the main takeaways here from this latest indictment against Trump?
So this indictment focuses on the chaotic weeks after the November 2020 presidential election when Trump was trying to stay in power and get a second term. And so it's a vast indictment in its scope. It recounts a lot of different episodes where Trump allies were trying to ensure he could stay in power. So a big part of the case is phone calls Trump made, which were widely reported on, where he pressured local election officials in Georgia, Republicans, to help him find votes to stay in power. Those calls feature prominently. They are connected to other acts going on in different parts of the state. And what's woven together is a story about how Trump and his allies were using a lot of different prongs in a strategy to keep him in power. So there's also talk about how voting machines in a rural county in Georgia were inspected by Trump allies. And the indictment alleges this was a conspiracy to do a data breach. And then that's tied to public statements Trump made. So using this RICO statute, the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, is telling a really big picture story.
Yeah, on that, Yann, RICO, or state racketeering, seems to be at the core of this case. Explain how prosecutors went about this.
So there's a federal law called the RICO Act from 1970 that was created in large part to take down a mafia. It made it easier to connect the heads of criminal enterprises with the underlings that actually carried out crimes. And so what's really interesting about this case is that it uses Georgia's version of the federal RICO Act to allege that there's a criminal enterprise that was in a pattern of criminal behavior. Rudy Giuliani is a defendant in this case, and he was famous for using the RICO Act as a prosecutor to take on the mafia. So in a way, a tool that he helped develop is now being used against him.
And so this is now the fourth indictment against former President Trump. Beyond the sort of breadth of charges here, the number of co-defendants, how does this stand out and compare to what we have seen so far?
So there are now four criminal cases against Trump. The one that the Georgia case aligns the most with is the federal case about Trump's effort to stay in power. It's the same core nucleus of facts, and so there's some factual overlap. That case was brought by the special counsel, Jack Smith. And in that case, Trump is the only defendant. Legal experts say that might have been an effort by Smith to really streamline that case and help it move along quickly toward trial. We see a different approach here with Willis. She has brought a really broad case in some ways, charging Trump along with 18 other people. That is obviously going to make it more complicated to bring that case before a jury. So Trump faces these two election cases, and then he's also been charged over his handling of classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort, and he's been charged in New York State court over an alleged hush money payment before the 2016 election.
And has Donald Trump responded to this? And have any of the notable co-defendants said anything since this case was announced?
So Trump has reacted to the indictment. He was obviously prepared for it, as many of us were. And he's reiterated his stance that this is politically motivated and that Willis, a Democrat, is biased against him. And his lawyers have said, you know, they plan to show that there are all sorts of constitutional defects in this process and in an indictment that was created from it.
And we should note that Giuliani has also responded, calling the indictment an affront to American democracy, as well as saying that it does, quote, permanent, irrevocable harm to our justice system. Yan, Giuliani and Trump are two of the 19 defendants in total here. And you said that the breadth of this case could make it more complex to prosecute. What does that tell us about a potential timeline then ahead of next year's election?
So Willis said during her press conference announcing the indictment that she is ready to try the case in 6 months. That may be optimistic, especially because Trump faces three other pending criminal cases. So those cases were filed before and are moving along. There is going to be a lot of logistical mess to sort out because Trump is charged with 18 other people. And they may say, you know, I don't want to be tried with Trump. I'd rather be tried in a subset or on my own. Everyone deserves their day in court, and judges are going to ensure that. So that is not easy to do, and this is going to be really messy and will take months to sort out.
It was Wall Street Journal legal affairs correspondent Yan Wolf. Yan, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a tale of two economies as data from China and Japan offer contrasting portraits of stagnation and growth. That and more after the break.
Technology can make the world better. At UST, we're building a future where people everywhere are empowered to live better lives.
It's transformation you can feel.
And you don't have to do it alone.
We believe in the power of technology to transform businesses and build a better world.
Now to China, where we're receiving yet more signals today about the country's economic frailty. The People's Bank of China this morning unexpectedly slashed a range of key interest rates in what is being seen as an emergency move to reignite growth, while the National Bureau of Statistics said that it would stop publishing data on youth joblessness, which had been marching higher in recent months. Journal Heard on the Street Asia editor Nathaniel Taplin told me that both moves follow the release of disappointing economic data.
So retail sales slowed again, down to 2.5% year-on-year growth. So not a big slowdown, but it was already at a very low level at 3.1% last month. The key thing is there that China has dipped into deflation on the headline consumer price index. And so the fact that consumer retail sales continue to weaken on top of falling prices is obviously a very, very negative sign. And so it's no surprise they're worried about that. And then on the industrial side, industrial production was up only 0.1%. So it barely grew at all. So you look at those two numbers together and basically you have a picture of an economy which is essentially very close to stalling out completely. So it's no surprise that they're worried and they're trying to do something.
So in terms of what they are doing, Nathaniel, let's talk first about these rate cuts. What should we make of this?
Many people weren't expecting another rate cut this summer at all, but they did. You look at the recent lending data, which just came out, and it was really, really bad. The net new bank loans were the lowest, actually, since 2009. And a lot of that is really, really, really weak new mortgages, both because people are prepaying the ones they already have, and just the general market is very weak. And there's trouble also in the trust sector, which is China's shadow banking sector. There's apparently some defaults on that over the past week as well. Those are often linked to property. So basically you get a picture of lending as a whole slowing really, really rapidly. And the housing situation is worsening again. And so it's no surprise they're taking rates down, but it probably won't be enough by itself to arrest the deterioration.
And we've also got, Nathaniel, a deterioration in youth unemployment, though China now won't publish data on that anymore. Explain that one for us.
Well, I think it just shows how sensitive all of this has become. I don't think anyone really, definitely in Beijing, and then also most people globally, really expected China's economy to lose steam again as quickly as it has. And one of the places where the problems have become most acute is this youth unemployment situation, which has been above 20 for a couple of months now. And that's become a major point of discussion on social media, certainly in the foreign press. And, you know, this isn't actually the only recent sign of Beijing kind of clamping down on the release of economic information. We at the Journal had this story a couple of days ago, you know, on bankers, on IPOs coming under pressure to say nicer things about the Chinese economy or the Chinese regulatory system in their prospectus documents. There's also been the clampdown on due diligence. Economic data has always been sort of politicized in China, but now, given how bad things are, and particularly how it's gone into the youth unemployment, it's a negative signal for sure.
That was Journal Heard on the Street Asia editor Nathaniel Taplin. Nathaniel, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
From struggling economic growth in China to an unexpected surge in Japan's economy, where fresh data is pointing to a 6% economic expansion in the second quarter. Reporter Megumi Fujikawa says, with the exception of a brief spell in 2020, that is the fastest quarterly growth in Japan since 2015 and marks the third straight quarter of growth.
Car exports increased after supply chain problems eased, and the surge in foreign visitors also helped increase spending. However, economists say weakness among Japan's trading partners such as the US and China means the rise in exports may not last, and some economists expect the Japanese economy to shrink in the third quarter.
Meanwhile, Russia's central bank has raised its key interest rate at an emergency meeting this morning, with the move coming in response to a sharp sell-off in the ruble, which is down 20% this year. The bank's move raises rates to 12% from a previous 8.5%, a day after the currency temporarily fell past 100 rubles to the U.S. dollar for the first time since the weeks after Russia invaded Ukraine. The ruble is now one of the world's worst performing currencies, adding to Russia's financial woes as the economy battles resurgent inflation, the mounting impact of sanctions, and a drastic labor shortage. Now to news of another bankruptcy in the crypto industry. Crypto custodian Prime Trust filed for bankruptcy protection late Monday after it faced a shortfall in customer funds. Finance reporter Patricia Kausman says the filing is just the latest ominous sign for the broader crypto industry.
Basically, what they did was to hold dollars on behalf of crypto firms, big ones like FTX, Binance US, Celsius, parking the funds in its own bank accounts. So it's basically a custodian whose work played a pretty big role when it comes to infrastructure of crypto markets. When Binance US struggled to find a bank after Signature Bank collapsed earlier this year, for example, they were parking money, including customer funds, with Prime Trust. So it's a pretty big bridge between, let's say, the crypto world and the traditional financial world. And if Prime Trust is gone, that leaves even fewer options for these crypto firms to tap.
Prime Trust said it intends to explore a number of options, including a potential sale. And if you haven't noticed, streaming prices are on the up, with a Wall Street Journal analysis finding that the average cost of watching a major ad-free streaming service increased by nearly 25% in about a year. That comes as the likes of Disney Plus and Apple TV bet that customers will either pay up or switch to cheaper but more lucrative ad-supported plans. Though Netflix is testing a new way of retaining customers. The streamer is bucking the trend of raising prices and instead branching out into another frontier, gaming. Netflix announced Monday that it would test games on more devices like computers while giving TV gamers the ability to use their phones as a controller. And while for now the beta test will roll out to just a small number of subscribers in Canada and the UK, the company says it's still very early in its games journey. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.